Welcome back to Unplugged here on Onc Live and MedUse Week. I'm very honored to have a friend here, Tejas Patel. I met him at our University of Colorado meeting here at ASCO Review in the past, and I was just kind of fascinated about his knowledge base and how wonderful communicator he is. And he does so many research studies. And so he's won so many awards, Rising Star Award, Tory Career Enhancement Award. And also, he's an international thought leader. He's on the current NCCN guidelines for small cell lung cancer and also non-small cell lung cancer. So I'm very happy to have Dr. Patel here with us here at Onc Live. Tejas, how are you doing, my man?
Chandler, thank you so much for having me on. Thank you for that extremely kind introduction. It's nice to actually have a conversation with you after a long time. Feels like overdue.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that you always kind of miss out on is at ASCO, I missed you this year. There's just so many people, so much data. This year's ASCO is just remarkable. I mean, with the plenary session, what are your thoughts about this with the lung sessions at ASCO this year?
Well, you said it best. It really was kind of some oncologists in the social media Twitter space have called this ASCO lung. And I don't disagree. I think that a lot of the big practice-changing abstracts, especially in thoracic oncology, were presented in ASCO this year. I mean, we're just talking about the plenaries and the oral sessions. But I mean, even if you go down to the mini orals, there was actually a lot of very important abstracts and data that was released here. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely made my work challenging. This was not a sleeper ASCO for me where I could just go and enjoy.
So let's go ahead and get started. You know, I know you've done some research with the EGFR, and the EGFR stories with the FLAURA study, then you had the ADAURA study, now you got the LARA study, you got so many neoadjuvant studies coming out in the future as well. So what are your thoughts about like the LARA study?
Yeah, LARA is, I think, one of the big stories that came out of ASCO. I think it's perhaps one of the most controversial studies. And part of the reason I think it's so controversial is it's really redefining our concept of curative intent. So for audience members who may not be familiar with LARA, it's a phase 3 randomized controlled trial. There were 216 patients with stage 3 EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. They had to have undergone chemo radiotherapy, and then they were randomly assigned 2-to-1 to receive either osimertinib or placebo. And the big punchline for which Suresh Ramalingam received a standing ovation was that there was a PFS benefit that was, I mean, you could drive a truck through that. It was 39.1 months versus 5.6 months with a hazard ratio of 0.16. Yes, 0.16. The overall survival data wasn't mature at the time of presentation. But I think the key take-home points, and Alicia Sequest, I think, did a really fantastic job as a discussant of this abstract, was that we really, as a medical oncology, have, and I think this is based on historical precedent, thought of treating patients with, quote, curative intent. And then when they relapse, we treat them palliatively. And I think when we look at the raw statistics of the relapse rate amongst specifically EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer who have stage 3B, they're in some senses really kind of behaving like early stage. If you looked at the placebo arm of this study, 78% of these patients had progression within 12 months. Now, some of this could be due to inadequate staging. You know, I don't believe a PET CT was mandated per protocol. Some of this could be variance in radiotherapy regimens. So all of that is baked into the heterogeneity. But I do think that even if we had a mandated PET CT and we had high fidelity to a very specific radiotherapy regimen, a significant percentage of these patients would relapse. And to me, I think when we step back and just think about this conceptually, offering osimertinib after chemoradiotherapy is perhaps the most optimal time to introduce a very highly effective tyrosine kinase inhibitor. We know that chemoradiotherapy does reduce in some percentage of log cell kill. It's not 100% given the relapse rates, but it's not zero either. And if we think about resistance as sort of a stochastic process where it's really just cancer cells trying to figure out different ways to get around drug. Over time, I think tumor volume plays a huge role here. And so introducing osimertinib after chemoradiotherapy, when there's probably the lowest population of cancer cells capable of forming resistance, to me, this functions like a nadir. And I think this is the appropriate time to introduce osimertinib. Durvalumab included in the control arm. There was some critique about indefinite osimertinib. Are we inappropriately treating patients? But I mean, I wanted to get your thoughts on it too.
Yeah, Tejas, you know, I think one of the things for like the general oncologist is you had these adjuvant studies and there's usually like a timeline. You know, you think about like the ADAURA study, what was it like 3 years or something like that? But then you look at some of the updated data, there's a question of whether that line is coming down. And so now the question is that one of the considerations of doing indefinite osimertinib? Because I feel like from our patient's perspective, it's an adjuvant study. Unlike the Pacific study where, you know, these patients receive a definite end to treatment there, I think that's one of the things our patients are going to kind of start thinking about. What are your thoughts about that with continuing with the treatment?
So I think the issue of adjuvant fixed duration osimertinib, there was a very good abstract. This was abstract 8005, looking at the ctDNA liquid biopsy dates from the ADAURA study. This was a very interesting study. Because what they did was they looked at patients in the ADAURA trial. And so just for the audience, the ADAURA trial was similar in concept to the EGFR study we just talked about, which was the LAURA study. However, the ADAURA study looked at stage 1B to 3A. This was based off the AJCC 7th edition. Specifically, were interesting, the endpoints were DFS, and they also now recently presented OS data. This abstract specifically looked at MRD monitoring in this patient population in this trial. This was for the ADAURA study. And to be clear, this was tissue informed. So this was a NeoGenomics personalized assay. They basically did whole exome sequencing of the tumor that was resected. They looked for tumor specific variants and then created a personalized blood assay that they used to follow patients long. So the take home message that I got from this abstract were, first, 12% of patients were MRD positive at baseline. We'll come back to that. MRD positivity preceded a disease-free survival event. It was 4.7 months in this study. So, and then this is, I think, the really important point. And this gets to the time-fixed osimertinib question. So 36% in the placebo arm were event-free at 36 months, which means that 64% were MRD positive in 3 years. And then this is the kicker. So 58% of MRD events in the treatment arm, which was the arm that got osimertinib, occurred 1 year after patients stopped osimertinib, right? So to me, the time-fixed approach for osimertinib really doesn't make sense. I think these patients, a high percentage of them will relapse once you start osimertinib. And we just have to have broader time horizon windows. I mean, in some ways, this is reminiscent of some of the questions we had with hormone receptor positive breast cancer when we started looking at 5 years and then magnifying out to 10-year horizon. So I think we need to start thinking about timelines like that for EGFR non-small cell lung cancer.
Yeah, that's a great point, man. I just feel like that sometimes maybe the clone is already there. It's just like in the background. It may not necessarily just take off. And so by continuing the treatment, maybe you kind of keep the fire down and make the clones from like, you know, reproducing and mitotically growing. I mean, it seems like there's some kind of stem cell where there's a genetic abnormality at any time it could just kind of take off.
Yeah, it's possible. And I mean, you know, we know that there's certain somatic alterations that certainly increase the risk for acquiring resistance. You know, there's been a lot of work on TP53, but there's actually been a really nice paper by the Swanton group that looked at specifically how is it that TP53 kind of facilitates resistance. But you know, if we just think about the stage four population for a second, so if we just look at stage four EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, we already know that patients who show up with an oligometastatic presentation do better than patients who have wide metastatic disease. So if you have a patient that has a lung met and a single bone met, that patient generally is going to do better than a patient who has widespread metastatic disease. And I think what Laura did is extended that one step prior. So instead of it being oligometastatic, what if it was a stage 3B patient? Well, they're probably going to do even better than those oligometastatic patients that we routinely resign to treating with, quote, palliative osimertinib. I just think the outcomes long-term for this patient population is going to be better. And one of the questions I get asked is, well, what What does that mean? Does it mean that patients are just going to have to be indefinitely on osimertinib? And what I counsel my patients who show up to my clinic is I want them to start thinking about this like the HIV model. We don't cure patients with HIV in 2024, but we do render it a chronic disease. We manage the side effects. We manage the side effects of the antiretroviral therapy. And if now HIV has, obviously it's a different disease and the control rates with antiretrovirals are different than TKIs, understood all of that. But I think that conceptual model helps, right? That you can let people be on a pill. It has side effects. We're going to manage that. You're going to see us routinely for management of long-term side effects. And I want patients to go and live their lives. I think patients will accept taking osimertinib. If they know that this will extend their time horizon for years, then yes, they will probably be okay with it. Hear a lot about MRD, you know, could we perhaps find a subgroup of patients who have MRD positivity in the LoRa data set, and maybe those are the ones we target. And I think that's an interesting question, but the big issue is sample availability. So unlike ADORA, where you could do whole exome sequencing on a resected surgical specimen, most of the diagnoses when you have unresectable stage 3B are coming from a bronchoscopy. So they're either going to be some kind of FNA sample, or in the best case scenario, you might get a CT-guided lung biopsy. But even in those situations, that is not nearly as much tissue as a surgically resected specimen. And so I wonder what the actual ability to construct a personalized MRD assay would look like in a stage 3B population. So this is an interesting thought experiment to think about logistics.
Yeah, I love that example with the HIV. And, you know, one of the things that I think about is the patients and the CNS penetration. And so, you know, the LoRa study and the ADORA study, very strong with the CNS penetration, lowering that risk. But then it also asked that question, like it was at the World Lung last year, where you had the FLORA 2 study, where you had chemotherapy with osimertinib, and that actually even more so lowered the CNS toxicity. What are your thoughts on that advanced setting, Tejas, like you kind of mentioned there? FLORA 2, is that what patients would you consider for that?
It's a hard question, and I'm still trying to think about how to integrate FLORA 2. The main take-home point that I actually got from FLORA 2 was that we actually finally got a better sense of the adverse event profile from use of osimertinib with platinum pemetrexed concurrently. I think that had been a long point of contention. Prior to FLORA 2, many oncologists had varying practice patterns. Some would continue osimertinib with platinum pemetrexed chemotherapy after progression. Some would just do platinum pemetrexed chemotherapy. A big cited concern was there was no safety data. I think FLORA 2 actually helps answer some of that information. I think regarding the brain mets data, it's complicated because one of the practice patterns that we routinely do in patients with brain metastases is we oftentimes do consider stereotactic radiosurgery. And while I understand that there's a radionecrosis concern, the radionecrosis concern really is driven by the size of the tumor and not so much the volume. So if you have several subcentimeter mets, and let us not forget that osimertinib is actually a CNS active drug, you know, I do think it's, you know, do we, just because they have brain mets, do we give them osimertinib plus chemo? My general take here and my impression is no. I would probably favor osimertinib up front and then see how they do after 3 months and then maybe try to salvage whatever we can, if we need to, with stereotactic radiosurgery. The patient that I think the FLORA 2 data makes the most sense on, there's probably two, and they're not very common, but we do see them time to time. One is a patient with just widespread metastatic disease and huge burden of disease. So all axial skeleton is involved. They have spleen mets. They have weird visceral metastases. That's probably a very high-risk patient. I might want to treat that one with osimertinib and chemotherapy. The other patient is the patient for whom SRS was never really a possibility. So there are patients that we see who have like 50 brain mets at diagnosis or have leptomeningeal disease at diagnosis. That might be a patient population where I might think about introducing FLORA 2, but I don't know if that's going to be my go-to patient. And I think the challenge is going to be, how do we define high risk?
Yeah, those are valid points. I think one of the things that you mentioned is just spectrum of all of the patients that we have to kind of think about and continuation of treatment. So we talked about the stage 4s with FLORA, question FLORA 2. We talked about the ADORA. you know, with the adjuvant, and then we talked about the LoRa after chemo radiation. So that begs the question, we had these cancer patients less than 3 centimeters with the DORA 2. I mean, the data is not out there yet, but is this something that we're going to be kind of thinking about, those less than 3 centimeters, where we start thinking about targeted treatments there? Because then you get the whole stage 1 to stage 4 covered. What are your thoughts about that, Tejas? Just because you're one of the leaders on terms of TKIs.
I think stage 1 is where I'm going to hesitate a little bit, just because we can actually have pretty good cure rates with kind of standard approaches. So I think the instructive point for LoRa was that we really don't cure stage 3B patients. There's a very high rate of relapse. I can't quite say the same is true for stage 1, especially if they're not, you know, stage 1B using the AJCC 8th edition or lower. I get nervous with the prospect of doing TKI either in an adjuvant approach there, or even in a neoadjuvant. My biggest concern with neoadjuvant is that we may actually potentially downstage patients. So I think if we're going to do a neoadjuvant study, there has to be a mandated endobronchial ultrasound or some kind of surveillance. It's not sufficient enough to just say you have a PET CT, it's clear, go on this trial. I mean, I think we find a lot of these patients may have occult N2 nodes or pathologic N2 nodes that we find postoperatively. So I don't know if where we should go with stage 1 EGFR lung cancers. I will also mention that they're unfortunately rare. We don't usually find patients who are stage 1. There was a fantastic lung abstract out of Taiwan looking at rates of screening in ever smokers with a family history of lung cancer. I think it's worth thinking about whether screening certain high-risk populations makes sense so we can find more of these patients. Unfortunately, they don't show up. They're usually either late stage or metastatic.
Absolutely. You know, I was just thinking about what you were saying about mandating for the stage 1s, and this is a good transition. It's kind of very similar to those rare stage 1 small cells where, you know, you do the surgery, but you still have to kind of work them up, mandate, make sure they do that meatanoscopy and all that. So very similar approach. So any lasting thoughts, Tejas, before we move on to small cell?
No, I think the EGFR space has gotten very complicated. You know, we have, especially, let's start with the metastatic setting. So we have the osimertinib data. We have osimertinib chemo, that's LoRa 2. There's also Mariposa data looking at amivantamab. I won't necessarily want to get into that, because I think all of this is sort of evolving and in flux. But I will say that the main take-home point I will have for the metastatic setting is I think we still need to really understand what does high risk mean and who would be best served with what regimen. I think when we go to the earlier stages, so when we look at like ADORA and LoRa, I think my main point there is that I think indefinite use is actually critical. And part of that is sort of conceptual based on how we think about resistance, thinking about an oligometastatic stage 4 patient does better than a widely metastatic stage 4 patient, ergo a stage 3B patient will probably do better. But also if you look at the abstract I cited earlier, the 8005, within a year, over 50% of these patients who stopped osimertinib had MRD positivity. So to me, that really frames the issue that if you're going to put someone on a static therapy like TKIs, they need to be on them long term.
And you know, this is a well-managed medication in terms of toxicities. It's probably, of the TKIs, it's probably the most manageable. Any kind of in terms of toxicities that you've noticed, Tejas, from giving this medication often?
Yeah, it's an interesting treatment. I mean, most patients do reasonably well on it. Expected side effects are all what you would expect from an epidermal growth factor receptor blocker. So they involve diarrhea, skin rash, you can see nail changes. I think one of the more challenging side effects is if you get these sort of fissures right on the finger pads, especially a lot of our patients, they tend to be young, they tend to work, they might have technological jobs. So it actually makes typing very difficult. Those are some of the more problematic side effects. I think there's a very rare risk of pneumonitis and also a very rare risk of non-ischemic cardiomyopathy that might actually require a treatment change, but on the whole, it's pretty well tolerated. You know, this is no everolimus or some multi-kinase VEGF inhibitor that we use in renal cell carcinoma. I mean, I think these are much more well tolerated.